Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know, even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
But you say, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Thank you.
Hello, this is Deborah Yao with Black Education TV, and I'm going to be discussing tiny homes, the whole tiny home movement. It seems to be catching on in the Black community as well, because owning a big home with a large mortgage is just not the way to go anymore. A lot of people bought into large homes, big mortgages, and they did so without realizing the impact that it will have on their future. I did a video before where I talked about mortgage and what it actually means. It means death pledge. And so a lot of people are trying to opt out of this because you literally lock yourself into a lifetime commitment just to own a home that you really don't own, because if you don't make your payments, they will come and take it. Now, I hear those who talk about the whole idea of, well, you never really own land because they can take it because of taxes and things of that nature. The difference with the tiny home movement is once you build that structure, and if you have it built right, and if it's on wheels, you can move that home with you. You can take that home with you. A lot of people are having tiny homes built that are movable, portable. And so they can go literally travel the country and have their home in tow with them. You see, I think it's a great option because when you look on YouTube, there are a lot of people who are building tiny homes that are very affordable, and they ultimately own it free and clear. No strings attached, no mortgage, no anything. They own it free and clear. And they're a lot more solidly built than just a regular travel trailer. And so they provide permanent living for a lot of people. Some people have their tiny homes parked in their friend's backyard. They may lease a piece of land. They may go to an RV park or a trailer park or just any temporary type situation. There are even so-called tiny home communities that are developing around the country, because a lot of people are tired of living large and not being able to afford it. And especially if you're single, you don't need a whole lot of space. A tiny home provides you with ample space and storage and all the things that you need to live and survive in this ever-changing world where expenses are just going through the roof. What I'm happy to see is that a lot of so-called Black people are jumping on this bandwagon as well. That's why I'm sharing these images that you see now, where more and more are saying, look, this is what I'm going to do. This is how I'm going to live my life. I'm not going to live my life in debt, wondering if the mortgage company is going to come and take my place, if I can't afford to pay it any longer. These are great options that are being presented right now. And I think more and more people, especially in the so-called Black community, are going to start looking at this as an option. There are a lot of empty nesters where it's just a husband and wife or just a single man or single woman who may not be able to afford conventional living. And so when you look at tiny home videos, even though I have a large family, I love looking at tiny homes and how they're put together, because there are a lot of people who feel like they're running out of options. And there are many options out there if you're willing to explore. Now, I have heard single people or small young couples say, well, no, that's too small. I've even heard individuals say that too. That's too small for me. I would feel too cramped. But when you're presented with fewer and fewer options and it's becoming more and more expensive to live and buy a house and all of this, then you may consider this option at some point. Although it may appear to be cramped, but imagine if, let me just throw this option out there. Imagine if you were able to buy just 2 acres of land. Many times you can grab 2 acres, 3 acres, 5 acres very, very cheaply, depending on what area you're trying to live in. You might be able to get 2 to 5 acres or even 1 acre for less than $10,000. And for some of you, that's your tax rebate or your tax refund. Or that could be your savings. But get the land this year and slowly build on the tiny home, getting help where you can. I mean, I've seen women actually embark on a project like that all on their own. And there was one woman whose video I looked at. She was twice divorced. And she said both divorces kind of like put a strain on her financially. And so what she decided to do, she said, okay, look, I'm tired of this having to get out of my house because I'm getting divorced or what have you, and now we have to split the house or whatever, the splits of dividends from the house. And so she decided that she was going to build her own tiny home. And I would say she looked like she was in her 50s. This woman looked like she was in her 50s, but she got her hammer, her nails, her wood, and her structures, and she just went for what she knew. And she built herself a really nice, tiny home. A really, really nice, tiny home. You can start off with something basic at first, but when you think about your future and how expensive it is to live and how prices just seem to be going more and more through the roof, they're going up. And if this can be an option for you, even if you feel like it's too small, if you feel like it's something you don't want to do, just consider it. Keep it in the back of your mind as something that you may want to consider with all of these rising costs. That may be an option for you. I've seen some very impressive tiny homes, including the ones that you see, some of the images you see. I've looked at their videos, some of them, and they've built some very impressive structures. Even if you're a new family, just starting out, husband and wife, and you may only have one child or you're about to have one child, this is a great option until you are able to do better. Even with two children, as your family grows, you can think of something different. But if you need time to save money and you haven't started a family yet, this is a great option. And when the time comes, if you need something bigger, you have this thing that you own free and clear that you can sell to someone else, which can be a possible down payment towards something bigger, or perhaps a down payment towards buying land, or maybe you can sell it to buy land and do something more permanent, do something bigger than a tiny home but still affordable. At this stage in the game, as we look around this country and see how things are playing out, how the dollar is shrinking daily, all of us are going to have to come up with other options. All of us are going to have to consider downsizing. It's kind of funny when you see articles pop up, abandoned mansions. It's funny when you look at these images of these big, beautiful houses, 5 and 10,000 square feet, where they're calling them abandoned mansions. Some of them have been empty for decades. Some of them recently empty. This is because people are saying, look, it's too expensive trying to take care of this big monster, you know. And that may not be the case for everyone, but a lot of people are starting to wise up. And they're starting to say, look, we don't need this much space. It costs a lot of money to run this place, to heat it, to cool it. And especially if your children have moved out, a lot of people are saying, look, I got to do something different than this. When you think about living to pay for a place to live, meaning you're working just to pay for it, it starts not to make any sense at all to you. And so I was very inspired to look at these young people, look at these so-called black people who are grabbing hold of the tiny home movement as a way to look at the future, as a way of surviving, where they don't have to look at homeless, the possibility of being homeless anymore. I think it's something to consider, family. It may have to grow on you, but I would encourage you to look at some of the videos of what people are doing out here, how they're making it work. Just kind of shift your thoughts around. I know we like to have big and bad homes and cars, but that kind of stuff is playing out. It really is playing out, and we need to start being more realistic, especially if you have children that are about to be empty. Not empty, but you're about to be an empty nester and your children are leaving. You may want to give them this as an option. show them the tiny homes and what they can do with them. Because when they get out here into the world and they start to pay high rents or high mortgages, they're going to feel like they're just throwing money down the drain. And if you can show them early on, hey, this may be an option for you. If you as a parent have land or space for them and they still want to feel like they've moved out on their own, let them park their home on your land, on your property. I've seen a number of situations just like that where a young couple, they want to buy a home. They can't afford it. They can't afford to buy land. So mom and dad say, hey, build your tiny home right here on our property. And they can stay there for many years while they're getting up on their feet, saving up their money. So if they want to do something different at some point, they can. And this affords them the opportunity to do that, because when you jump out into life incurring all these big bills, car note, house note, taxes, insurance, all of this stuff, it's like before you even get your life started, you're going into it in debt, especially if you already have college debt. You'll feel like you're just living just to pay your debt. And that's no way to live. That's no way to start your life. So, again, family, I hope this encourages you to consider something such as tiny homes. Once you build it, it's yours. No one can take it away. There's no mortgage attached to it. It is yours. Even if it's parked on a temporary situation such as a lot or in someone's backyard, at least it's yours. If you have to take it elsewhere, you can. All righty, family, and with that, I will say shalom.
When you think of Hopkinsville, chitlins probably aren't the first thing that comes to mind. But from the 1930s through the 60s, Hoptown was one of the premier stops of the chitlin circuit, a series of towns throughout the South that African-American musicians traveled during segregation.
Because the country was segregated at that time, the chitlin circuit kind of got created by the migration of Southern musicians out of Memphis, out of New Orleans, out of St. Louis, and the old, as we used to call it, gut bucket blues of the Alabamas and the Mississippis out in the woods and the fields, if you will. And they were called the chitlin circuits because mostly chitlins was a big meal for blacks at that time, inexpensive, cheap. And if you worked on a farm as a sharecropper or as a farmer, you sold the good meat, you kept the chitlins.
Hopkinsville's unique location and attributes, including its proximity to Fort Campbell, home to thousands of soldiers eager for off-base entertainment, made it an ideal stop on the circuit.
Hopkinsville was very active as far as the black community was concerned. There were a lot of black troops that came to town, and blacks owned quite a section of downtown Hopkinsville where the night spots were.
If you go back to the 30s and early 40s, Hopkinsville was almost 60% black, the third or fourth largest city in the state. So it dominated western Kentucky and made it an interesting go-to place.
Bigger bands that were moving, say, perhaps from the north to the southern cities, and they needed places to stop over to play in. Some of these are maybe smaller venues, and Christian County was more or less sort of a mecca for some of these bands.
This was a place for entertainment to come. And if you got to the state of Kentucky, Hopkinsville was a place to be.
It was the first place you could really stop that was of any size or significance. And as African Americans, you didn't want to stop in the little small out-of-the-way places. So you tried to wait until you got to the larger spots, if you will.
And the list of artists that performed reads as a virtual who's who on the music scene.
Usually once a month or twice a month, you had some name entertainement here in town.
Seems like Hoptown has had their share of outstanding musicians to come in here. I mean, Count Basie and all those guys came in.
I remember coming to Hopkinsville when Basie was here, and I remember the sound of that big band coming out of the building. We couldn't go in, but I remember the sound of that music coming out of that building, just kind of, man, this is it.
I remember when Chubby Checker, he came out, he made the song The Twist popular. It was just becoming popular, and I remember him walking through that door. Ike and Tina Turner. Tina became real good friends with some of my girlfriends at the time because they would come monthly and got to know her real well.
James Brown, Little Richard,
Ray Charles.
I saw Cap Calloway. I was a kid then.
I remember the people out in the street, they all couldn't get in, so people were out in the streets, dancing in the streets, and just having the best time of their lives. We actually felt like we were in New York City. I mean, Hoptown was the place to be in those days.
Fort Campbell brought one of rock and roll's greatest legends to town, Jimi Hendrix. He was a longtime circuit regular, performing backup to a number of different artists.
He played, in support of some of the probably Clarksville, Nashville bands. He never headlined anything around here. And if he played for anybody in Nashville and any of the groups that the owners hired or promoted here, he was unknown.
Although too young to attend the shows, many Hoptown youngsters found creative ways to sample the music scene.
When those guys came through, most of us were, too young to go to the clubs.
When I wasn't invited in, I skedaddled my way in anyway, so that's how I got to see.
Push me through the window so I can get a drink.
As a kid, 11 or 12, I had an uncle who was, quite frankly, a bootlegger, moonshiner, and he would come to Hopkinsville from time to time to sell moonshine. So he would bring us younger kids with him to town because that would discourage the police or the revenuers from bothering him. See, kids in the car, they can't be doing anything wrong, even though the trunk was full of moonshine. And for us kids, the benefit was we got to hear all of this wonderful music from all these big bands that we'd only heard about, that were from New York and Chicago and all those other places. 5 days a week, this whole area was nothing but hard working. I mean, we're tobacco, it was agricultural primarily. But on Friday night, Saturday, it was let it go. And so for us kids, it was like going to, oh man, this is Christmas.
The end of segregation ultimately brought an end to the necessity of the Chitlin Circuit across the U.S.
That's what killed the Chitlin Circuit, I think, more than anything else, was the evolution of one, music, and of the sociology of the time, which was integration. And that opened up the whole country where you didn't have to worry about, can I stop at this restaurant and eat? Can I stop at this gas station and go to the bathroom? The need for a Chitlin Circuit, which was almost a necessity in its day, no longer existed or began to wane rather dramatically.
But the memories of those legendary nights remain vivid to this day.
I certainly, as a kid, enjoyed every minute standing outside of those clubs and those bars listening to these bands that never in your wildest dreams did you ever think you would be able to see or hear, and to actually see one of the musicians going into the club, getting ready to play, died and gone to heaven.
I like it, bitch, she is true. But it's not nice to fool Mother Nature. The proud mother of God, like all hoes, is jealous of her own shadow. Who is this young decayed bitch who wished to be queen for a day? Who would sacrifice the great grandsons and daughters of her jealous mother by fucking the brains the oldest
person? Oh, I got
the Come on now. Come on now, goddamn. Come on, can you put me in a room? Come on, look at this. What's that? You know how I take it. Look at that. It's a gross motherfucker. Okay, come on, man. Come on, come on, come on,
come on. A luscious bitch, she is true. But it's not nice to fool Mother Nature. The proud mother of God, like all hoes, is jealous of her own shadow. Who is this young Britannic bitch who wished to be queen for a day? who had sacrificed the great-grandsons and daughters of her jealous mother. By sucking their brain until their ability to think was amputated, by pimping their instincts until they were fat, horny, and strung out. In her neurotic attempt to be queen of the universe, who is this bitch?
$25 a night. The first year in comedy, I made $3,000. Second year, I made $5,500. The third year, I made about $7,200. I became homeless. You make $15,000 in 3 years. That's how you get homeless. That's why that lady was out here, Miss Deborah, feeding homeless people, because I was one of them. I lived in a car for 3 years. Because I wasn't making enough money. But guess what? I kept telling them $25 jokes till they started paying me $250 a night. And I kept telling them $250 jokes till they started paying me $25,000 a night. I kept telling them $25,000 jokes till they started paying me $75,000 a night. Then I told them jokes for $75, then they started paying me $125 a night. Then I kept telling them, they done paid me $500,000 for these jokes. Without the kings of comedy, We made $58 million in 1 year. You know what we did? We told jokes. Them the same $25 jokes. They ain't nothing but English. Ain't wasn't like I was doing them in Spanish or no like that. I was the same funk jokes for $25. I just kept repetition over and over and over. I turned them jokes into an empire. I turned them jokes into a lifestyle beyond my wildest dreams. I turned them jokes into funds. My grandkids ain't got to worry about nothing. I done put up so much with them $25 jokes. You are sitting on an empire. You are worth millions. That's how you become a millionaire. You don't try to think of a million. You just do this $10 thing you got over and over and over. You're sitting on money, man. That's how you get rich. Quit trying to figure out how to make a million. Take something, a $10 idea, and just do it, and keep praying about it. Keep asking God to show you the next level. Keep asking God for strength when it looked like you ain't going to make it. When I was homeless, it looked like I wasn't going to make it. I kept praying about it. Kept asking God to come get me. I kept leaning on my mama. Man, she said, he didn't bring you this far to leave you. I kept hearing her say that. You know, I could have gave up a long time ago, but I never gave up. I just kept fighting. God is going to come through and do what he say he going to do, but you got to give him something to work with. If you do that, God will change your whole life. I dare you to try it. I dare you to take your gift and do it over and over and over. Watch what he do. The Bible says your gift will make room for you and put you in the presence of great men. Don't say nothing about your passion or your education. Your gift. If you do that, God will change your life. Thank y'all for coming.
If you know where to look, a map of Africa holds a secret. On the shores of the Atlantic, 5,000 miles from America, there is a place called Maryland, founded by freed American slaves who set sail from Fells Point 17 decades ago.
But they found a new day, actually. That was a new day. They found it here.
Tonight, a remarkable adventure with 11 News reporters Tim Tooten, John Sanders, and photographer John Brosnan. A journey back in time and across the globe to rediscover Maryland's long-lost family.
Most of our fathers, our grandfathers, came from America.
It is a place and a people that have been lost in history until tonight.
There's so much valuable history. There's so much link. There's so much in common that we have.
This is the Maryland America forgot. This is Africa's Maryland. Republic of Liberia, Tim Tooten.
Hello from Harper City on the remote western coast of Africa. We're a long ways from home, but there's a familiar feeling here, and Baltimore Street runs right through the middle of downtown. We've traveled thousands of miles to see this place, to walk in the footsteps of freed slaves who left the bondage of our Maryland to build free lives in this new Maryland, a world away.
Tonight, we will retrace their daring and dangerous journey across the Atlantic. We'll meet their descendants and uncover the few surviving clues of what they began here. We'll be going to places never before seen on American television. A remarkable story has been left for us to discover. A story still playing out here in Africa's Maryland.
Today, much of Maryland County, Liberia, looks just as it did when the first settlers arrived from Baltimore in 1834, a tropical paradise where palm trees and white beaches stretch untouched for miles. 4,900 miles southeast of Baltimore, Maryland is one of 15 counties in the country of Liberia on the southern tip of West Africa. It's less than half the size of our Maryland and home to about 90,000 people, less than 2% of Maryland's population in America. Just off one street in Maryland's capital city of Harper, there's a hidden spot where history happened. Local historian Henry Wart leads us through the brush to a shaded beach where those first Marylanders set foot on African soil.
This place is supposed to be, and it is, the spot in the vicinity on which the first group of pioneers that came to establish the state of Maryland from the United States arrived.
It was the end of an historic journey that began on the other side of the Atlantic, in our Maryland. In 1822, the American Colonization Society, funded by the U.S. government, began helping emancipated slaves and free blacks return to Africa to their own colony called Liberia.
And it was almost an instinctive idea of going back to Africa.
Richard Hall literally wrote the book on Africa's Maryland. And on Africa's shore, he explains why Maryland broke away from the national colonization effort, which was influenced by pro-slavery interests.
They specifically stated in a new charter that their purpose was to eliminate slavery in Maryland. They intended to create a homeland for American, specifically Maryland's black people in Liberia, separate from Liberia proper.
Maryland would ultimately send more than 1,000 settlers to its African colony. In 1834, the first arrivals were welcomed with a ceremony not too different from what we encountered at the seaside village of Kavala, a few miles from Harper City. Settlers met the local population called the Grabo, already living in what would become the Maryland colony. Though the Grabo still speak their own language, many already knew English when the first Americans arrived, thanks to British traders sailing Africa's coast. Early documents from those days can still be found, tucked away at the Maryland Historical Society. Among them, a handwritten letter sent from Africa in 1836. Settler Eliza Jane Wilson wrote to her father in Queen Anne's County.
My dear father, you will see by this letter that I have arrived safe and in good health. Here I can enjoy myself, can come and go when I please, and there is no one to trouble or trample on me. I don't say you will be rich, but if you want liberty, I say come.
Despite her optimism, Eliza Wilson would die of disease 5 years after her arrival in Africa. Early settlers faced hunger, illness, and tensions with neighboring tribes. In 1834, Joshua Stewart wrote in despair to his wife in Baltimore. He was ready to return to America at any cost.
Oh, I am sorry. Yes, sorry that I ever came to this country. I will sell myself for a slave for the sake of getting home once more.
Shocking as that letter sounds today, historian Henry Wart says it's not surprising. Those were difficult times.
Some people got sick and died on the ship. Not all of them arrived, sir. And when they finally arrived, some even besides the seasick got attacked by malaria. It was a dangerous thing. But in the end, they knew that the end would justify that means. They knew when they finally arrived, there was light in the end of the tunnel. And that light was liberty, freedom.
For 22 years, more than 30 ships sailed from Fells Point, bound for Africa's Maryland. It merged with the neighboring Republic of Liberia in 1857 and took the name Maryland County. For 7 days, we traveled the muddy, bumpy, almost impassable roads of Maryland County. We found little that remains of what the first set was built when they arrived from Baltimore. One exception, this Episcopal church in Kavala, built by missionaries who arrived in 1834 on the first ship from Baltimore to America. Behind the church, the graves of early settlers born in America, Boston, Massachusetts, Milton, Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C. Crumbling but vivid reminders of forgotten family ties. We also met Alexander Brewer. He lives in Harper City and still has relatives in Maryland, USA. He's a descendant of the free slaves who settled this country.
So they said, okay, we'll take the challenge of the sea. We'll jump on the sea, we'll jump on a little schooner, and we'll go as far as we can go, because they already had some feeling or thoughts that they will find freedom along the west coast of Africa.
For the freed slaves who settled this country, the trip from Baltimore took more than 2 months. Today, it takes only a few days, but it's still a trip you must see to believe. Here's John Sanders on the grand adventure from Maryland to Maryland.
It's not easy to get to Maryland County, Liberia. There are no direct flights from America, so we go by way of Brussels, Belgium. It takes us 2 full days just to get into the country, landing here, Liberia's capital, Monrovia, named for American President James Monroe, an early supporter of colonization. Many of the city's residents are refugees of a civil war that just ended in 2003. About 1 million people live here.
When you first arrive, it's a city that overwhelms the senses. It's difficult just to move around on these streets, choked with traffic and blasted by war. It's said that bumps in these roads aren't potholes, they're rocket craters.
Maryland County is still more than 200 miles away from this capital city. Back home, that trip would take a few hours, but Liberia's roads get even worse outside Monrovia. The war left them so dilapidated that it would take 2 hard days to drive to Maryland County. So our only option, hitch a ride on a cargo helicopter run by the United Nations. They're here keeping the peace as Liberia recovers from the fighting. Inside, it's not exactly first class, and it smells like bread. We're hauling food for peacekeeping troops in Maryland County. Soon we're in the air, following the Atlantic coast south. For 2 hours, we stare out the open windows at some of the most stunning scenery I've seen anywhere on Earth. Mile after mile of untouched beaches and rainforests. As we descend, we calculate it's taken us 6 days to travel from Maryland to Maryland. And as we leave the helicopter, we realize these Marylanders have laid out the red carpet. We didn't expect to be the center of attention, but here we are, receiving the keys to the city and being shown Liberia's trademark handshake, ending with a snap of the fingers. Why all the excitement? They tell us we're the first American TV crew to visit Maryland County in at least 30 years. That devastating civil war has kept visitors away.
As recently as the 1980s, these streets here in the city of Harper were filled with traffic, and these rotting buildings were seaside mansions. Liberia and Maryland County were called jewels of Africa. Those freed slaves' dreams of a promised land continued until their paradise became a nightmare, and Africa's Maryland suddenly turned deadly and dark. Civil war in Liberia began in 1989 and continued for almost 15 years. Its causes were complex, but some of the origins date back to Liberia's earliest days. The descendants of American slaves were always the minority among the native population of Liberia, but it was often the slaves' descendants who held political power. Violence began in the countryside, forcing refugees to flee only with belongings they could carry to the safety of the cities. Not all of them made it. They were often stopped at gunpoint along the roads.
We just, you know, call out one or two persons and accuse them, you know, and just kill them beside you. We saw that. I saw it personally.
As refugees flooded the capital city, Monrovia's population quickly doubled from 500,000 to 1 million. Those decades of pent-up tension led to unimaginable brutality in places as unlikely as this Lutheran church on busy Tubman Boulevard in the nation's capital. In 1990, more than 3,000 people were sent here for safety. On July 29th, soldiers broke in, hunting for the father of rebel leader Charles Taylor.
The massacre lasted from the early morning up to late morning, around about 5, 6 o'clock.
Reverend Thomas Pay is pastor of the St. Peter's Lutheran Church. At the time of the war, he had been assigned to another congregation just outside the city. But each and every day, he relives the massacre.
On that morning, the men were in here. The women were in the school building back there, the St. Peter Lutheran High School, next to this building. Women and children were there. They used machine gun and matches, cutlasses in the Liberian way. When they ran out of ammunition, they took knives and other things, and cutlasses, and began to chop out the limbs of people. We have preserved this so that people will see and know indeed that the people, these soldiers, were in the church and they were shooting at people. Now you can see it's a bullet hole. It's a sizable bullet. There was a body here. The person was trying to escape, and they fired at him. That's why you see this mark.
And that's just one painful reminder of what happened here on a day when more than 500 lives were taken and a place where they'd hoped to find peace. Instead, they were forced to sacrifice their lives, leaving behind a legacy not easily understood.
The people that were massacred in this church were buried under here. This is a very big grave. Well dug, and the bones were put into that. It got filled and it was covered. Now many of the kids that are playing basketball here don't even know that they are bones under here. They don't know.
At Jiffy Lube, we care about cars. In fact, we're kinda obsessed. That's why we've been taking care of business with quick quality oil changes and service for over 40 years. And with things like our Carful Vehicle Review, where our experts will check, fill, clean, and inspect your vehicle, you'll know we'll care for your car like we care for our own. Jiffy Lube. Car more.
Visit JiffyLubeDC.com to find a Jiffy Lube service center near you.